Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of React Roundup. I am TJ Van Tol, and with me today on the panel is Paige Niedringhaus.
Hey, everyone.
And Jack Harrington.
Hello.
And our special guest for today is Attila Fassina. Attila, welcome.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we could start by, you could just tell people who you are, what you do, why you're famous, all those good sorts of things.
I wish I was famous. So I'm Brazilian developer, currently living in Berlin, freezing Berlin as right now. And I work as a lead front-end engineer at SAP. Previously, I was working in a company that got acquired by SAP. So yeah, I just switched jobs without moving. And yeah, so I've been pretty much involved with Next.js stuff in the last couple of months, writing a few articles and doing some workshops and finding out ways to actually scale some of the apps I work with for it. So that's pretty much what I've been about lately.
Cool. Hey folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topenddevs.com/podcast and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv, and I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topenddevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topenddevs.com.
Yeah, and I know you've done a lot of writing and work on Next, and I know there's a couple different things we want to get into, but maybe you could just start for the beginner listeners out there, just explaining, you know, what Next is, why you ended up picking it, like, was it a good fit for an app you were writing? Maybe just cover some of those basics, and then we can use that, jump into some of these more specific topics.
Yeah, so Next.js started with me, like, I think was... the first time I tried it was version 2 or something. They are now on version 12. And to me, it just felt like great developer experience for grabbing React and turning it into a very performance-friendly and efficient application. So Next.js is considered kind of a meta framework. So it's an opinionated set of tools around the React ecosystem, and it's going to provide you with a nice railway if you want to build an application and you want the heavy stuff to be handled already for you. So right now they handle like Babel configuration, Webpack, SWC. They're doing like some very nice revamps into their infrastructure to use Rust and be more faster, to the point that they're now calling themselves an SDK. So it has a lot of stuff if you want to build apps. It's very versatile. And one of the things that I actually like the most about it is how it can be very opinionated if you just want to borrow all their conventions and definitions, but it's also really easy to break out of some of those conventions, some of those definitions, and then follow on building your own thing. So yeah, that's pretty much how I got into that. And why I stayed is because I think they keep evolving and getting close to what the platform is actually going towards, being it with streaming static files with and partial rendering, incremental static regeneration, this kind of stuff. It appeals a lot to me. So yeah, I just find it hard to get away from it.
Just to contextualize a little bit, what are you using it for in your day job?
So in my day job right now, we are in the process of actually, we're evaluating some changes to our infrastructure. And the thing that appealed to us a lot is because we have several React applications and accessibility it's always been an important topic, but now we're doubling down to some standards and server-side rendering becomes rather important at some points. The strategy for performance also helps a lot. And the way, because it's essentially a React application, it becomes sort of easy to refactor a single page app to use Next.js and to, and I really like the new ways of importing modules, for example, that are like, I think two of them are experimental still on Next.12, but they're pretty nice, like dynamic imports with URL. I think they call URL imports actually just mixed with dynamic imports, which is another way of lazy loading modules. And the external directory where you can actually fetch modules from different parts of a monorepo. If you should have a monolithic monorepository, that's a different discussion, but you can. So that's interesting. So I really like that, and I think that that's pretty powerful. So I like how it's versatile and how you can leverage different stages of where you're building your application to handle the data and to optimize it. So you have different ways of fetching the data, you have control over your compile time, you have control over the rendering time, you have control over when you're going to re-render something or not without needing to deploy the entire thing. So I think it offers like a very nice combination of features. The features are really nice, but it's really cool when you're actually figure out ways to put them together and make something that's tailored for you without that much effort in many cases.
For the dynamic importing bit, am I remembering it correctly? Is that the part where you can essentially bring in modules from almost like a URL, right? Like, or like you just have this flexible syntax for importing stuff? Am I remembering this correctly?
So the dynamic imports, you have different ways to do that. So there's one of them that you can define if the modules are going to be like they're basically what's the like they're pretty similar to the dynamic imports of with Webpack, for example. So they are in a separate chunk of your bundle, and then you can define if they're going to be imported on rendering on the server or only in the client, and if you're going to use suspense or not, this kind of stuff, concurrent mode. And then the URL imports are the ones that you import from a CDN directly. So that's this experimental. The dynamic imports are not. But yeah, they're pretty similar.
Gotcha. And I imagine part of the reason for that is the performance, right? Because if you have control over when, I guess, like where that code is built in, you can control just when the user is going to have to download that to try to make everything as snappy as possible,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
Exactly. And then you can, if you're using like URL imports, you can actually achieve something pretty close to federated modules. And then, but on Next.js, it's just a Boolean that you change on your Next config. And then boom, you have federated modules when you need it. So like that's the kind of stuff that I really like about the developer experience.
Yeah, I almost feel like when we truly have that, like there's so much we could possibly do. because I mean, if you can bring in a module from a URL, right? Like you could,
yeah.
Like there's so much from like an experimentation point of view, right? If you want to try out some library on the internet, if you could just pop it in through a module and everything works in your app, that's kind of cool. Or even like what you're saying, just even within your company, like you could point at different URLs. It's just sort of just gives you cool ways of breaking up your app that we really haven't done before.
Yeah. So, and that's the part where I think we're actually a little bit hesitant on taking like the federated approach with importing modules directly on the client side runtime, is because it just gives you a lot of way to break your app on or make it like super heavy. And that's actually the part that I like most. And to me, appeals a lot on the server components. And actually Next.js already has some examples of that, because then if you want to try something fancy, something cool, something different out, you can actually have your component rendered on the server and then you bring it in afterwards. So to me, that's really nice when you have like some component, I don't know, like my go-to example is always a date picker. Mm-hmm. Because you actually import a bunch of libraries to just handle like an input sometimes, and that's really annoying. Like your bundle just doubles the size because of one input. So if you can render that on the server level, then you have only what the client actually needs. So, and then on the re-render, it just takes the props out, which is basically what the server-side props do for you. But now on a component level, you can do that with Next.js on a page level, but with when server components are out, they're in beta now, then you can actually do that on a component level. And to me, that just that's just like all the benefits of what like this federated module / micro front end, whatever when you want to name it. To me, that's all the benefits without the downsides, I would say, roughly, I guess.
So, Attila, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was now you work for SAP, which is a very, very large company. And you talked a little bit about how you scale up applications to handle, I'm sure, large amounts of data and also large amounts of users. Do you have any tips for people who are kind of, because that seems to always be a question that comes up, is how do I take this thing that works for me locally or for maybe a few of me and a few other people and make it work for thousands or tens of thousands of people concurrently? Do you have any tips for that with Next.js?
So that's actually a problem that we're daily trying to figure out. I would say that the nice thing about how not only Next.js, but most of this GemStack friendly or serverless approaches bring to the table is how we can leverage the cache and how we can actually leverage edge computing to it. So on Next.12, we got like the middlewares, which are edge functions on top of Cloudflare workers. Remix just came out and it's entirely like you can ship your entire application to the edge. That's a way to like have a very snappy experience with being close to the user through the CDN and have good cache control, because then with the modern browser, like thankfully, I hope all of you are free from i11. So we can actually use the platform a lot for cache control stuff and to handle this kind of performance and try to keep the data, like try to use the data stale as much as we can without exhausting some resources. So this has been something we've been looking at heavily. And as of now, we're actually having a look on different kinds of performance, trying to have better traceability of this kind of things. And we're actually looking at some rendering, how to improve rendering for things, because once you get like a bunch of users, you start getting some really, really interesting edge cases that people find out. So, yeah, you just... To me, what has become like a rule of thumb is try to identify low-hanging fruits and address them as soon as possible. And then if you have good benchmarks, you always have a hint on where to optimize next.
So like, where are those low-hanging fruits usually?
So to me, the low-hanging fruits are usually when, like what we've been looking at mostly is how we actually handle the data. So the first low-hanging fruit for rendering performance would be what kind of re-rendering you're triggering. And then again, there's this big fallacy that re-renderings are always evil. But like, I think if you have like cheap re-renderings, they may not be that damaging. But if you have like one very expensive re-rendering that may not happen that often, but it's still like is being triggered unnecessarily, that's a good point. So basically avoid wasting your resources. So why would you fetch things that don't change that often? Or like, how can you leverage cache for a better user experience? That's been something that I've seen very often that helped me a lot when doing like Lambda functions, for example, being really conscient about how to set up the cache controls. And that's something that I started doing very late, but it's something that has proven to me to be very helpful. So yeah.
So going back a little bit to what you said, not only about caching and making sure that the data stays in session for a while, but you also talked about benchmarking. Do you have any examples or recommendations that you would recommend for benchmarking? Because that's something that I've definitely tried to do with teams in the past, and it's not as easy as we would think with React or single page applications to try and get that good baseline in general, and then figure out then how can we make it better or faster.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that for most apps, like if you want to get started quickly, I would say looking at Web Vitals, they're usually the first go-to thing. And then there are a few metrics that I find there, like usually like on inside the Web Vitals that to me are really important. Like one of them being the largest Contentful paint. But and then again, there's always the difference between and here's the part where benchmarking is important, because sometimes the metrics are going to vary for your application how important they are, because it depends if you're optimizing for SEO, if you're optimizing for conversion, if you're optimizing for interactivity, this kind of stuff. But usually, large contentful paint is an important metric, because it tells you on the first view how long it takes for that large, usually blocking resource to load. And that can be very damaging to perceived performance. Like in most cases, when you're handling with user experience, you actually need to keep an eye on the perceived performance. Your website might take very long to load, but then if the user has a snappy experience or if they can interact to it early on and get what they want out of it, it doesn't matter that much. So large contentful paint is one of them. First input delay is very, very important, because basically it's how it handles your this kind of perceived performance. So if your app is something that relies a lot on user interactivity, on settings like a dashboard or something, you want to have the first input delay as low as possible. So these metrics are like quite important. And circling back to Next.js, they have important optimizations for it. So for example, if you have like, if you're a content website that has that big hero image like we see so often, the image component that they offer gives you an attribute that's a priority, which is a Boolean. So you can set, okay, this image, I know that's going to be the largest contentful paint, a large contentful paint for my view. So you can just set it priority, and then Next.js is going to bump it on the prefetch. So it's going to give you significant improvement for that. And this can affect not only the perceived performance of your user, but also your search result page. Since it's a content website, it might be important. Another thing that I find important, and for first input delay in the same sense, if you have something that's like an expensive task, I would say that right now it's interesting to consider using Web Worker for this kind of things, because we have JavaScript right now, like asynchronous programming became something that's pretty ubiquitous. Like everybody has at some point dealt with promises and this kind of things, but they're not truly parallel. So you have the asynchronous programming, which is still concurrent. They go execute a micro task and go back. So if you have a very large, or if you're, for some reason, I hope you're not, but for some reason, you're crunching amounts of data and that's blocking your rendering for some reason, you can toss up a web worker and that's going to put that on a different thread. So there are different, different kinds of apps, like native apps that actually handle, I think Android has the UI thread pretty isolated from the other. I don't know how they call it in JavaScript land. In web worker land, we would call it worker thread and main thread. So the UI is responsible for the main thread. And then you can toss it up to a worker thread. And in the end, it's just about handling how a different data fetch would be dealing with, and you can still have that snappy experience. I have a demo about that somewhere, because I had a talk about web workers, and I am actually I found a way to block my UI with a promise even, and I execute the same task on a web worker, so it's pretty cool. But yeah, and it's pretty easy. Like you can pretty straightforward. I mean, like there is some boilerplate into getting the workers working, but it's you can get it done with pretty much any compiler. There's a very nice library from, I think it's Surma or the whole Google team, I don't know, called Comlink, that uses the proxy API to, like, it's basically what async and await did for promises. They're doing that for web workers. So you can actually toss some tasks to be executed on a worker thread without feeling like it. So it's pretty nice. So you just need to be aware, if you're doing like very legacy browsers, it uses the proxy API, which I think the I think i11 doesn't support it, but yeah.
Well, to go back to your point about the native browsers or native like Android and iOS, threading is kind of complicated there, but they try to make it easy for individual developers, but a lot of native APIs sort of intelligently handle the processing for you. Like I think the most go-to example is scrolling. So your UI table view on iOS, when you scroll, it's really performant because iOS has an algorithm under the hood that's taking care of the heavy lifting, the processing, like multi-threading, all that stuff for you. Whereas on the browser is kind of dumb, right? You create a UL in the browser and you throw 1,000 things in it. It's not doing anything for you. It's just going to dump those 10,000 things on there and good luck from there. And so what I like about what you're saying too is because for better or worse, we as web developers have to deal with that, right? Have to recognize situations where do you need to care about that? And then if you need to care about that, what am I going to do about that? What strategy am I going to take? And I feel like Next helps with some of those things, like intelligently handling images, because it's almost like kind of replicating some of what native platforms do for you, because native platforms do stuff to help you with images. The browser really doesn't. So Next can help with that. But like you said, recognizing some of these other situations, it's good to have some background about strategies for approaching this.
Yeah. And also like when you import external scripts and this kind of things, that can also be very, very damaging. Like that tracking script that's on a CDN with a high latency for somebody in Samoa or Australia. It's always complicated.
With a name that's like 7 random characters and like... But marketing says it needs to be there no matter what. So there it goes.
Yeah. And then they end up, ends up instrumenting your code, like instrumenting the experience as well, right? To monitor and track stuff. And of course, that takes a performance hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time is of the essence when identifying and resolving issues in your software. And our friends at Raygun are here to help. Their brand new alerting feature is now available for crash reporting and real user monitoring to make sure you're quickly notified of the errors, crashes, and front-end performance issues that matter most to you and your business. Set thresholds for your alert based on an increase in error count, a spike in load time, or new issues introduced in the latest deployment, along with custom filters that give you even greater control. Assign multiple users to ensure the right team members are notified, with alerts linked directly to the issue in Raygun, taking you to the root cause faster. Never miss another mission-critical issue in your software again. Try Raygun Alerting today and create a world-class issue resolution workflow that gives you and your customer peace of mind. Visit raygun.com to learn more. Their simple usage plans start from as little as $4 per month with unlimited apps and users. That's raygun.com to start your free 14-day trial.
It's really nice to hear that web workers are becoming easier to work with, because I know that I've looked into them briefly in the past, probably not within the last year or so, but it looks like magic when I look at the code for how people are taking concurrently running tasks or parallelized stuff that they want to offload to it and actually get it to it and then get the information back. And it seems like a massive pain unless you really, really need it for some reason, or it's just, or the performance is just terrible otherwise. So it's nice to hear that they're really trying to start to make that very simple, kind, because you're right, async await was a huge game changer in terms of writing promises and being able to, you know, wait for multiple things to resolve before giving the data back to the user or displaying it in the browser. So if we can do the same sorts of things with web workers and have them just running in the background, but easily be able to access them and send tasks off to them, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the part that to me that's a little bit, it's makes it scary good is that if web workers become so popular and then we have single page applications and as front-end developers, we like to handle everything on the front-end and this kind of stuff, it might open like the Pandora box of, okay, let me handle this on the front-end. And then we end up like in the past where we started with single page applications, we started having these huge bloated apps that try to do everything and reinvent the wheel multiple times. Luckily now going back to see, okay, what the platform has. And then we come with this transitional apps approach that I think it's really nice. So there's always that as well. Like I think web workers are super powerful. They're becoming easy to use and with good support. But still, like, there's still like a resource to help performance. That's, they're not something you're going to blindly be using all the time. Like, there was some questions I was asked when I was starting talking about the web workers. At some point, somebody asked me, okay, so, but why would you have that? Why would you have this very large chunks of data in the front end? Said, yeah, I don't know why. I don't know if like for, if by any reason you need that, but there's this option. I think that we need to be able to use it. So that's the thing. Like, it is there. But yeah, we just need to be careful about when to use it and use it in a proper time, because we have so many different approaches to handle this kind of stuff. And it's nice to see people using them. But yeah, we need to be careful about what we use, I think.
There's a cool project called Party Town, which is, first of all, an amazing name, but it's from the people at Builder.io. And it's an approach that tries to put third-party scripts in a web worker. So it attempts to take those annoying like scripts, like marketing scripts, mm-hmm. and just let them run. They described that the name Party Town comes from, they want to put all those 30 party scripts in their own little island, right? To party by themselves and not affect the performance of your main page. And it's still experimental at this point, but it caught my eye because I think that's a problem that pretty much all web developers can relate to at some point, like just some rogue script that's going nuts and ruining all the performance gains you're trying to make.
And that's actually also interesting for security as well, because not all APIs are available on a worker thread. So you cannot manipulate a DOM, for example.
And, yeah, it's doing some craziness with like messaging back and forth. Like, it more or less tells the main thread what to do on the DOM. Like, it has to communicate that back and forth. So it's kind of nuts, and that's probably why it's experimental. But I'm hoping that they can succeed with that, because I think it's potentially pretty big.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think I saw something in the past about AMP team in Google doing some DOM implementation in worker threads, because that was the whole point of AMP, like running everything like asynchronous and isolated. So they did some heavy work on that. I don't know where it ended up in the end. I just didn't follow AMP that much. But yeah. Yeah, I just found here my proof of concept. I'm going to paste it in the chat.
Yeah, if you send it over to us, we can make sure it ends up in the show notes for people that want to check it out.
I'll fix the documentation before you publish the episode, I promise.
That's me. I've always got to update the README.
In this case, I don't even have a README, so...
Well, I know there's some other stuff on Next.js that you've written about and have some background on, and one of them that definitely caught my eye is localization, just because that is... I feel like that's one of those topics that people either don't care about because they don't need to do it, or like if you care about it, like you realize how much of a hornet's nest that sort of thing can be.
Yeah. So
I'm curious your background, like how did you get into localization with Next, and like I guess what sort of recommendations you have there?
To me, it came actually as the second case you mentioned. I had to do it at some point in my past, and I realized, oh my God, that's such a hornet's nest. It's so complicated. And then it's also like, it's a little bit appealing to me because, as I mentioned, I live in Germany, but I don't speak German. So I particularly hate when a website implies by my IP that I speak German and give me a website in German. So yeah, like my accepted languages are right there in my header. So why don't you use that? And then when the internationalization feature came out with Next 10, it just carries all the heavy load. And I realized, like, at some point that all the libraries that I used to be my go-to libraries for handling international in ITN were actually doing a bunch of those stuff. And that was actually the hard part, because afterwards, roughly in a nutshell, it's basically a mapping. So you have a key, you just bring out the string. Of course, there are more complicated aspects to it, like when you're interpolating, when you're doing other kinds of fancy stuff. But in summary, that's what translation library would do. And everything else, like inferring what's the correct language and doing the routing and this kind of stuff, everything Next.js does for you. So I started The whole point of their article was actually pointing that out, that the heavy lifting is done. And at some point, when I was doing the internationalization stuff in my past, I was talking with one of the developers that worked with me, and we were saying, oh, how nice it would be if we had a compile error if we tried to use a key that didn't exist. And TypeScript can actually give us that. So I started playing around with one of my pet projects, and I said, okay, I'm going to use ITN from Next.js to figure out the languages and stuff like that. And I'm going to create these fancy types. I really don't care that much about the rendering performance right now if the types are like complicated, because it's a very small project and I just want to see it done. So I did that, and the little translation library that was very rudimentary, it was just like pointing keys and to strings. I got done in about 5 or 7 lines, something like that. I said, oh, okay, like, I'm up to something here. So then I started writing the article. And then from that article, I said, okay, like, I can put it up on a different library and see how it goes. I can actually go a step further and make sure that instead of like shipping that whole JSON, dictionary JSON that I hate it. I hate bloat in my bundle in the end, with all those translations with the hidden states that my user is never going to reach, I can leave that on the server, because then I don't need to be chunking that JSON. I can have the whole JSON there because they're going to stay in the server. And I only pass to the website, to the page, what actually came out of the rendering. So instead of my translations being handled by language, they're going to be handled by strings. They're going to be handled by the components that are using them. So I have the different languages co-located on my runtime, but I have the languages separated. So that was the whole point. And then with that, I end up creating those few methods that I put on a package. It's still like very early stage. Like, I don't think nobody's actually using that in production. But yeah, it's something that I really look forward to have more time to invest on it, because in the end, my translations end up being like very small JSON for those, only for the stuff that are actually being used by the page at that specific moment. So I like that idea, and the point is that it was completely built for Next.js. It doesn't really work outside, but what it does is just creating some fancy TypeScript types with some generics and stuff like that based on your dictionaries. And yeah, so because they're very dependent on the data that's being passed to them, there is a chance that on a larger scale, they end up presenting some kind of issues. But yeah, that's why we have Rust now, right? So let's see how it goes going forward. I didn't really stress test that at this moment. It's just something, yeah, let's see how it goes. But yeah, that's how it came to be.
It sounds really useful, and it sounds like something that if you started to talk about it or maybe publicize it a little bit more, a lot of people could find that useful or handy for their own applications.
Yeah, I hope so. I really want to double down on this and do something more. I think like what happened was that I just wanted to make this proof of concept. And then at some point I realized, okay, I can start digging on this. And I didn't got to the end of where I was trying to get, I guess. So yeah, that's how the whole localization stuff was born for me. Reborn, I guess, like out of sheer pain on dealing with that in the past.
Yeah, this is neat to me, because when I've had to do localization in the past, essentially there was, the app had like a giant dictionary file, right? With like every string in every language, because there was no magic to be intelligent about that. So every user had to ship every translation for everything. And then you'd pass into your dictionary your key or whatever. So it's cool to see that there are ways, like I could, this, especially like apps that have to support a whole ton of languages, like I could see this being a really big deal.
Yeah, so like, and there's really no limit to that. And then at some point you figure out, okay, how do I scale this dictionary? Then you start finding out ways of breaking those chunks, but they're usually very elaborated. And then because you don't have any way of really tracking the keys that are being used or not, because, you know, there are keys that you build on runtime. Like you don't really, you have very few ways to make statical analysis out of this. So you end up keeping those dead keys in your JSON dictionaries in the end. So that's really annoying. So to me, a solution for this would be to avoid shipping the JSON completely and just keep them in the runtime. For Next.js, it becomes easy. It becomes easier because they do the heavy lifting for me, in the sense that if you're using, like, for example, get server-side props or get static props, what they do is on rendering time, they evaluate the logic you have there. And if get static props, they put the JSON that results from that logic they put in the bundle. If it's get server-side props, they create this API route that gets called on client-side navigation. So basically, they handle that for me. They create this little service for you when you're building something using get server-side props. The downside of that is that you can only use serializable data. So there is a little bit of runtime if you need to, like, interpolate. At least I could not find a way to statically interpolate variables. But you need to have this little function, have to have this little JavaScript runtime on the client side if you need to do interpolation. But yeah, it's pretty neat. Like, once you, like, you just have a hook and basically that's it, which you end up needing anyway if you're going to do the routing. So it's very lightweight, I would say, on the runtime.
Cool. Well, Tilla, this has been great chatting. Are there any topics that we've totally missed that we haven't got into before we start to wrap up here?
Not that I know of. As I mentioned, like, you just point and I'll shoot and I'll talk. And I just talk. Yeah, it's nice that we were talking before about state management and stuff like this, and then the chat ended up deviating to a whole different side, which to me, it was fun. I don't know for you if you had any plans. So yeah, shoot.
Well, yeah, you've got this article. Maybe we could just end, because I know you've written about state management and Next. I'm going to go ahead and link that in the show notes. You want to just, like, briefly describe for people to, like, give the short version of that, just to see if they want to check that out?
So yeah, so the point of their article was to come up with ways to isolate states between routes. So I think React, as of now, they have a powerful combination of hooks that can handle many, many cases of state management. Like, if you have the context API to avoid the prop drilling, and then you can use use reducer or use state to handle the applications, the states. With that, and then the whole layout paradigm that Next.js usually uses, you can use that to isolate some states across different routes. And then there's this pattern with get layout that is now at the official documentation, but you can find it more easily in the show notes with the article. But basically, a way that you can isolate routes. So, for example, if you have one route that's supposed to be authenticated and the other route that is not, you can just make sure that in your runtime, the route is not authenticated, there's no way of leaking data between them. So this is nice. This get layout part is really nice. I think it's a first step if you need isolation of data, and also avoid putting a bunch of providers that are unnecessary, because this is another thing circling back to the rendering performance, is that if you have, like, a bunch of context consumers that are in chain, you can be easily losing sight of them and triggering re-renders that you don't want to. So that's a way to isolate them. And then, yeah, there are different patterns that you can scale up from this. They're really nice. I tried to map them in that article. But yeah, roughly speaking, that's a nutshell of, yeah, that thing.
Yeah. No, cool stuff. And the article is called State Management in Next.js, which is SEO gold, by the way. I think you're going to get all the traffic. I don't think...
No, I'm not an SEO genius. I'm just really bad at naming.
Yeah, I think a couple people will Google that over the next couple of years. So I think you'll be doing all right.
Yeah, well, I'm just really, really bad at naming. I just start writing. I put, like, this placeholder title. I start writing. And then by the end of it, I said, okay, I don't have a better name.
Well, cool.
Hi, this is Charles Maxwood from Top End Devs. And lately, I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases, just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate, intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships, and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topendevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1-hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topendevs.com/coaching.
Why don't we then head into the picks? And Jack, do you want to kick us off today?
Yeah, sure. I have a project that I've been looking at recently. It's pretty obscure, but it's super cool. It's around GraphQL. It's called Wundergraph. And we'll put the link to that in the description. Wundergraph. And it's basically an interesting take on GraphQL. We've all been used to kind of the Apollo model of you have a GraphQL server and you have a GraphQL client. This one's actually interesting. It's server-side only GraphQL. And so what it does is it actually kind of compiles your GraphQL queries on the server side. And the actual transmission, essentially, the protocol is basic REST requests. And so it actually fixes kind of some of the performance problems that we, or potential performance problems you see in a very open-ended GraphQL API. So I'll be doing a video on that pretty soon. And I'm actually, it's really exciting. If you're into the GraphQL space, it's an interesting take on the GraphQL model.
Awesome. Paige, what picks do you have?
My pick this week is going to be something that's been out for a few months, and probably a lot of people on this podcast are already familiar with it. It's called React Table, and it's part of the Tanner Lindsley TAN stack. Yeah, Jack's giving it a big thumbs up.
Oh, yeah.
I actually, I had reason to use it for a side project that I've been working on lately, and I needed a table in a Next.js application. And so when I started Googling around, I mean, this one, hands down, was the most popular by far. So I gave it a try, and it is very, very easy to get set up with. The examples that they have on the website for all the different types of things you might want, like pagination and filtering and sorting and all that stuff, is just, it's really, really good. I was able to take one of their examples that does pagination and pop it into my own application, probably maybe 20 minutes tops to just get my data to format correctly for the table. But it is really, really good. So if you're looking for any sort of table thing and you have React, I would definitely say it's great. One nice thing, which could be seen as a downside, but I think is probably a good thing, is that it is headless. So you can design and do anything that you want with your tables look and feel, which I know a lot of people, I mean, it would have been nice to have some basic styling, but it's pretty easy to find some nice styled CSS to go with the table. So I would definitely say that's a great one if you need anything beyond the most basic table layout.
Cool. Yeah, I actually think there's like a movement lately to make some of these components just CSS less, right?
And yeah, headless. Yeah.
I actually kind of think it's a good thing because you let like different libraries focus on different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, cool. React Table is awesome. Like I had to refactor a table and I choose React Table, and not only fixed all the performance issues that I could have, but it also was really easy to adopt. And it's basically a set of hooks and you can just make it even accessible. You can even you can do pretty much anything with that. And it's really awesome. I recommend a lot.
Cool. My pick for this week is going to be Camtasia. So I've had to do a bunch of video stuff recently, and I've been meaning to check out Camtasia, and I tried it out. I think its greatest appeal is that it's quite easy to use, so you can make decent videos without having to be an expert video editor, which definitely describes me. So if you're like, I think its sweet spot is if you're in the like not super professional, like video editing isn't like your everything, but you're looking for something a little bit that can do a little bit more. Camtasia works quite well there. I'm a little bit biased because they're based about 20 minutes from me. So I felt the need to check it out because their TechSmith's headquarters is in Okemos, Michigan. So it's kind of just down the road from me. So I had some like personal reason to try it out as well. And it's working pretty good. Awesome. So that is my pick. Attila, what picks do you have for us today?
So I'm torn. Like I've been doing a lot of looks into XState and getting ready to like jump into the state machine thing, like head first, because yeah, I kind of need that for work. So I've been playing around and combining that with React Final Form, which is pretty nice. And another thing that I've kept my eye since it became open source, which since we talked so much about Next.js, everybody pretty much already has it in their heads, is Remix. So I haven't had much time to dig on to it, but I'm really looking forward to play around and see like the conventions and stuff like that. They're using the React Router 6. So it's a nice idea to like server-side rendered application supporting partial routing is interesting. So the idea to be edge first is appealing. So I'm looking forward to dig in and see more what they're all about. Yeah, you asked for one pick, I said two, so I'm sorry.
No, two is, that's it, you're off. Is then. Now, multiple picks is totally okay. Those are both excellent ones as yeah. Well.
Mm, absolutely.
Well, cool. Well, this has been a lot of fun chatting today. To the last question for you, if people want to follow you, where's the best place? Which links should we send them to?
So I'm usually on Twitter doing useless ramblings. So yeah, Attila Fascina. And I'm looking forward to catch up again with my YouTube channel, which was Attila.io. I started, did a nice month or two with a few videos, and then suddenly I stopped. So I look forward to get back to it and not stop anymore. But yeah, I was having fun.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for joining us. This has been a lot of fun. I definitely learned a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was really fun for me too. Thanks for having me. And it was really nice.
Cool. All right. Well, have a good week, everybody.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.